Hello friends, this is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. This is now the fifth episode in the series on occult and esoteric Christianity. I think I've got a few more in my pocket, but they're all very different. This is all about the evolving tradition of esoteric Christianity that offers vitalizing insight into how to move forward in our world. Across the episodes, I've been talking about different streams and fruits and figures in occult and esoteric Christianity. Rather than presenting the typically dogmatic, dominating, and totalizing Christianity, which is always in danger of being seized by people, especially conservatives, let's face it, in power, this series is presenting a different, and I see it as truer, form of Christianity: open, wounded, individuated, powerless. A tradition that relates Christianity to other spiritual paths without seeking to control or diminish them. So far, I've had two priests, reverends, from the Christian community, which is inspired by the esoteric work of Rudolf Steiner on. I talked about Peter Dunov and Daskalos. This episode, I wanted to talk about how esoteric Christianity is unfolding into new tasks, new work, new mysteries, particularly what I'm calling, and other people are calling, the new mysteries of the heart. What does that even mean? Of course, it's not quite clear. But to discuss all that in a clear but in-depth way, I invited writer and teacher Lisa Romero back onto the show. Before I introduce Lisa in the episode, I want to say, you know, some of the things that have been coming up for me is, what does it mean to change ourselves and change the world at the same time? I mean, there's so much tension there about, well, you can't just change the world by doing, you know, work on yourself, and you can't really get to where you're going in the world unless you do work on yourself. So how do you do that? And what would esoteric Christianity have to offer that? Well, I think quite a bit, actually. But how do we enter into the political realm by doing spiritual work? If you see the world and you're like, shit is falling apart, everything's bad, you know, wars, disease, hatred, you know, division being fomented between people, et cetera, et cetera. You could look at all of that and feel despair, or then you could take this other step and be like, actually, everything is just going according to this loving plan, and that's how I'm going to see the world, which is a different kind of seeing. Or, and this is a different move, and it's important, I think, to recognize the difference. You could envision a world where we are enacting love with each other, which is a completely different imaginative move. The turn from one to the next, the turn from I'm deciding to see it a certain way to I'm deciding to create within myself new pictures of how it could be, moves us into a different space inwardly, which is why, even though Rudolf Steiner didn't like this word, I knew he was talking about, I like utopia as a word, because if it requires you to move into a space of imaginatively and positively creating the world within, not just reacting to negative problems with a positive view, and also not just building a world based on what you don't want, instead creating within the new building in the ruins of the old, but building this new thing, then we have a little bit of a view of what kind of move needs to be made here.
The world isn't as it is, and just I'll just stay in my own positive framework. But that isn't actually the reality of your own development, because you constantly come up against what is not love. So you're going to go and meet that outwardly or inwardly. So the question is, how are you able to do something about it inwardly? Because if you can, then you can also consider what you can do about it outwardly. If I can't meet, if I refuse to meet my shadow, if I refuse to meet my shortcomings, if I refuse to meet the errors in myself, then I have not learned what to do about the transformation of that. So how I actually participate in this world shadow, this world error, this world process. So there are people that are living in this way where they just refuse to engage with that reality.
I play that clip because I think it's getting to the heart of the matter, sorry, of how we say things about love and inner development all the time, but we don't go far enough in refining it to make it useful, to make it something that lends to a circulation or a breathing between ourselves and other, the individual and the gathering of two or more, and then the gathering of the two or more into the all, the economic world, the way we're all connected on the planet. And so I think that we have these ideas about love and Christ and that sort of stuff, but they're not refined to the point where we can use them now. And that's what this episode in a lot of ways is about how to bring all that forward to face the challenges that we're met with. So it's not enough to just say it's all love, or love is all you need, or, you know, all you need is love anymore, without really understanding what that means or articulating it.
The substance of this version of the cosmos is love. So you can't escape love. You can only occlude love with love, which is very confusing. You can't do anything to it. I mean, it's all there is. So it's not the difference between are you loving or are you not loving. It's the difference between are you experiencing love in this way or in this way.
Well, we practice love, cultivate love, creative forces pour into the world. So love is, and yet what happens? Love is, you're right. But what happens when a human being practices love, cultivates love? Mm. And these creative forces, which are the future becoming, come into the world. And that's where we participate with the future willed by the gods, for want of a better way of putting it. And what is the other option? Well, we've seen it before, the rise and fall of great civilizations and cycles of time and time again.
The ability to articulate what these mysteries of the heart and love are has a lot to do with something that I think is kind of unpopular right now, which is purification. I think it's unpopular because purification is related to a kind of prescribed morality in most people's minds. Well, the church says this, or my community says this, my family says this, or even, I don't know, if you're straight edge or something, it says this, do these things to purify yourself. But purification is a deeply personal process, and it is really touching on the heart. If you have ever noticed, as I have, the ways in which certain things you do that you think are really beautiful at first, down the line you notice are not really working for you. So just sort of think about how you've evolved in love relationships in your life. For example, I used to think that being super vulnerable in my love relationships was really important. I still think that that's important. However, if I looked at how I related to that vulnerability in past relationships, and sometimes even now, I can see myself performing vulnerability to get what I want. So, for instance, if you've ever been in a fight with someone that you love, and you can see them kind of, you know, getting the upper hand, or maybe saying something scary, or remaining angry when you're doing your best to try to dispel the anger, and then you're like, well, I just had such a hard day, or I've been having like a hard week, and blah, 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 and this is what I'm going through, and it brings everything back down. I'm not saying that that's always bad or anything like that, but you might notice that you've done it to kind of get your way from them because they end up embracing you. Ah, oh, that's okay. I just needed to know all that, whatever. Again, it's not that context is bad. I'm not talking about the particular instance there, but I'm just saying there are things that we do that we think are really good and in fact do have a good side that are virtues that we practice so often that they become manipulative. So this is what I mean when I say learning to articulate love through purification, it can become very personal. Once you see something like that, you can feel really like almost ashamed of yourself, and it can keep you vigilant going forward. How do I really love the other in this moment? How do I offer them compassion and freedom rather than trying to get them to feel the way I want them to feel? So that's just a very small example of something much bigger here, which is this purification process. What in my life is not relating to honesty, to truth in the right way, to wisdom, to love, to goodness, to righteousness correctly, and not the ways that the church has told me, or my family, or whatever, but actually in my own way, my own understanding, as Lisa puts it in this episode, my own divine ideal. And as you start to commit yourself to that, you find yourself purifying in a way. So that's what I mean by purification. It does require sacrifice because you discover all sorts of things about yourself that you might want to hold on to give yourself an upper hand, but that just aren't really part of your integrity anymore. All of this is so important because it is important to understand what is meant by all we need is love, that love is all there is, God is love, and so on and so forth. These things that are deeply true, and we know them to be true, or maybe there's just a hint of their truth in our lives, but that don't really make much sense to us right now because they're so vague and they seem insubstantial compared to the huge problems we're facing, or the just many, many problems we're facing in the world. So I talk about all this and more with Lisa. We talk about how to find and dispel any inner fascist leanings we might have in our lives, what the limits of manifesting and positive thinking are in the spiritual path, the light of cosmic and earthly roses. I'll let you hear that one. Meeting in the mystery chamber of the spiritual heart, why utopia matters, and more. Lisa's been on the show four other times, most recently on episode 209 when we talked about the pitfalls of psychedelic use and magic. She's the author of many books, including Spirit-Led Community, Healing the Impact of Technology, and A Bridge to Spirit, Understanding Conscious Self-Development and Consciousness-Altering Substances. One of her latest efforts is The Astral Arc, which is an ongoing series of videos with different themes. The first set were Questions on the Path, where she discussed spiritual development with young people. And now there's a series of videos. They're short videos on the virtues, which can help us enter this mystery school of the heart that Lisa and I talk about on the show, each related to a different sign on the zodiac. You can find all those at innerworkpath.com/astral-arc. So that's ASTRAL-ARC, and then another forward slash if you need it. But if you just go to innerworkpath.com, you'll find links to everything. Before we start the episode, I want to say, I know a lot of you probably hear me say this thing at the top of the episode, each episode, which is, please do support the show at patreon.com/ConnerHabib, ConnerHabib. You probably hear that, and then, you know, for a lot of you, it's like, oh yeah, maybe I should do that. So if you're one of the people that does do it, thank you so much. If you've thought that, please do support the show. It means so much. It really circulates a lot of nourishment into the show, into my own life. And, you know, every episode of this show is free. It's available to everybody. And I don't have any sponsors because I don't like that. It's just not part of the integrity of the show. It doesn't make sense for this show, which is deep conversations about all sorts of really weird but also urgent things, and I try to be as heartfelt as possible. You can't really do that and then just interrupt it with an advertisement for something that you don't give a shit about. On the other hand, when people support the show by going to patreon.com/ConnorBeeb and contributing, it's like, oh, there's a reciprocity here. There's a acknowledgement or a seeing of the value of this show in people's lives. And that means so much to me. So you can do it on any level, any amount of money that you want, either in a one-shot annual contribution, which is something that a lot more people are doing these days, or a month-to-month contribution, which you can change any month. So patreon.com/ConnorBeeb. Do think about supporting the show if you don't. And if you do, thank you very much. Okay, so that's all. Here's my conversation about esoteric Christianity and the new mysteries of the heart with Lisa Romero. Hello, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Beeb. I'm so happy to welcome you back. Now a regular guest, Lisa Romero. Hi.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
I am going to talk for just a little bit. So if you're waiting for Lisa to talk, you will have to wait just a little bit longer. But I wanted to set up this conversation for where I think it can go fruitfully. So I'm going to start with a prayer. It's a prayer that I've brought up on the show already, talking about Peter Dunov, because it's a Bogomil prayer. The Bogomils were a group of Christians in the Bulgarian Empire in like the 10th century. And here's the prayer. Cleanse me, my God. Purify me inwardly and outwardly. Purify body, soul, and spirit, so that the seeds of light may grow within me and make me into a flaming torch. I should like to be my own flame, so as to transform everything in and around me into light. Now, I suppose I should say amen at the end of that one. I bring this prayer the day of this recording, at least it's the day after Whitsun, a Christian festival that a lot of people don't really think about or know about, but also it's known as Pentecost. And one of the features of Pentecost is the idea that there was a flame of recognition hovering above the heads of the disciples of Christ, a flame, a tongues of fire. So when I'm thinking about the torch, I brought that prayer in first just to sort of open us up with light and flame and torches. But I'm going to continue into a passage about Whitsun from Rudolf Steiner. And then I promise I'll let Lisa take it away. But here's Rudolf Steiner talking about Whitsun. And first, he's quoting Christ's words from the Bible. I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world. Those, therefore, who are earnestly at pains to experience the Christ impulse may also feel called on by what the Christ impulse arouses in their hearts, to proclaim afresh the word of Christ, even though it may sound forth ever new, ever different in each epoch of mankind. It was not that we might cling to the few words of the gospel spoken in the first decade of Christianity's foundation, that the Holy Spirit was poured down on men. It was poured forth so that forever the gospel of Christ may relate new things and again things ever knew. As the souls of men progress from epoch to epoch, from incarnation to incarnation, new things must always be spoken for these human souls. So this is how I'd like to start this conversation with flame, light, purification, and renewal of a mystery that is with us until the end of the world. So we'll start there. Hi. Hey.
Wow. You know, it's wonderful to hear that beginning, because before we came on, what has been my desire to talk about actually is what I experience as this newness that seems to be coming in. You know, it's like lots of us are feeling that we can't just go on with what we were just doing, that something has to come about that's not just a reliving of the past or even the step or the stage we were on before. Something new is trying to break through. And with that, I'm feeling from all sorts of directions, people speaking about their need to find this living spirit in a new way and ask, how will it be alive today in our individual lives, in our community life, in our collective life? So it's nice to hear that that's obviously speaking into you as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's speaking to me on the level of my own life and also the life of the world. It's so interesting to think about this knowing that something new needs to come through. I think when people hear that, sometimes they'll think of past times when people have said that. So the Age of Aquarius kind of hippie notion of it, for instance, which was passive. And there's a kind of integral studies, spiral dynamics, Ken Wilber thing, that's also kind of passive, that this will come in and we'll receive it. The water will be poured into our jug. But actually, what's happening now is an asking of us to direct. It was probably being asked then as well, but in a different way. But there's a much more active participation part. And this is so difficult because it might seem like we're less active than ever in a lot of ways, that we are not able to take action in our own lives, in the world, to direct world events, and especially a lot of us sort of coming out of feelings that remain from lockdowns and so forth, where we feel really pressed into inaction, inability, in the sway of global events and viruses and policies and so forth. And yet, here we are being asked to think and feel and act in new ways, completely to usher in what is absolutely necessary to reorganize and change the world, the cosmos, ourselves, our own lives, our relationships, a total life reform. So I just want to maybe start there, because I think when we say something new needs to come in, it's like, well, we remember that last time, or, you know, whatever my memory of it is, like, well, consciousness will change and all, you know, don't worry. It's the Age of Aquarius, peace is coming. And also that we feel like we're passengers in political circumstance, world circumstance, environmental circumstance, rather than directors of it.
Yeah. Well, I think in a way there's this interesting reality that there are these cycles, that seem to endlessly grow, expand, become something, and then through some sort of greed and debauchery or hedonism, you know, implode upon itself. I was just reading this poem from Lao Tzu, who was talking about, you know, as prospectors speculate while farmers lose their land, you know, this is 3,000 years ago. And you could read that poem as though it was taking place today. So there are these cycles, and they belong to that sphere that you're talking about, where we can look outside and think, this is just this turning wheel that will take itself to a certain level of destruction. But that's inside that cycle that we don't participate in the way which we illusionarily think we can. There is something else that is new that has to take place within the human being. And this picture of working within what I'm, you know, framing around this mystery center of the heart, this new mystery center of the heart, is something new in the way of which we can individually participate in what used to be given as a lawful form from the gods, as it were. Mm-hmm. Now, what I think is happening, and I think this is also something that many of my colleagues and dear friends are feeling, is that there is a kind of recognition that the form itself won't carry for much longer without our participation. Mm-hmm. So there are forms of which we work towards lawfulness of life, about evolution, that if we don't participate, will not carry us any longer. And one of those impulses is really connected to Christianity, to the Christ being, the being of love. There's this agreement, really, that we're left free unless we engage in that participation. And so it is through this new mystery center of the heart that there we meet this participating with the being of love, and this unfolding of the next evolutionary step. And, you know, fundamentally, esoteric Christianity is formed on love and freedom. It is, you know, the central axioms that everything passes through. But with this need now for our individual participation. So what I find very interesting, the spiritual esoteric path, the royal path, which was the path of the initiates, was always about individual participation. You know, if you entered into any initiation schooling, there's no onlookers, there's no congregation, there's no one standing by. Anyone that's there is a participant. Everyone has a role, a place, a robe, a sign, whatever it is, you're participating. That's the stream of initiation. And then you have this sort of priestly stream, the pastoral stream, the religious stream, where the priests do the work and the congregation are kind of onlookers, perhaps observing what is done, but not actually asked to fully participate. And that's where the lawfulness, the religious law, the spiritual forms have been held for humanity. We do the good. Why? Well, that form has been given. That's no longer good enough. Do-gooders are doing damage. Why? Because it's empty form. Unless you can participate individually, it's a repetition of an empty form that doesn't belong to you. So it's this mystery center of the heart where we find the individual relationship to the virtues, the good, the cleansing, as you talked about, the word, we find our individual relationship to it, and we begin this new law, what we might think of as this solar law, the heart being the sun of our internal microcosmic system. And this solar law is this living relationship to it. So how do we get there? How do we now start working with this, uniting this individual consciousness development of the initiation path and this priestly pastoral stream of the collective path, and bring them together? And that's the work that I think is the new right now for me, where I'm working, and for many.
I'm just laughing because there's just so much, like, one of the great things about having you on is that because we know each other very well, we don't, we'll go there, you know. I mean, with a consciousness of everyone, all of you who are listening, but so many things have just shown up in what you said. I mean, one, I just want to say, again, there's this Whitsun thing where, you know, Steiner points out the Easter is a movable feast, that it's not like Christmas on a fixed day, but follows the stars. But Whitsun is fixed in relationship to Easter. So you have this fixity and this movingness that are at play in what you're talking about as well, that there is a sun and there are planets, and we have the role of, you know, taking up Easter and Whitsun as well. And I think, you know, when I think about that, it's like, I spent so, and I'm sure a lot of people who are listening can relate, I've spent so much time developing my intellect and my intelligence, reading philosophy, going to see great works of art, ballet, concerts, you know, reading great novels, seeing great movies, that sort of thing. And I think so much of what happens in people when they hear, oh, you need to go into your heart, is they hear an anti-intellectual sentiment in that. But what I've come to understand over time, and really understand rather than just intellectualize, is that as you develop your spiritual life, you absorb the intelligence into a different aspect of your being. So when we talk about the mysteries of the heart, we're not actually being anti-intellectual. In fact, it's a total redemption of the intellect, and it gives so much more dimension to it. It stops becoming that merely reflective two-dimensional surface of the mirror, and instead begins to live differently when you bring the intellect in your heart. And I just will say one more thing. I'm going to read a poem, which you, I'm sure, know. But this is Rilke's poem, Archaic Torso of Apollo, because, again, this relates so deeply to what you said, which is, we cannot know his legendary head with eyes like ripening fruit, and yet his torso is still suffused with brilliance from inside, like a lamp in which his gaze, now turned to low, gleams in all its power. Otherwise, the curved breast could not dazzle you so, nor could a smile run through the placid hips and thighs to that dark center where procreation flared. Otherwise, the stone would seem defaced beneath the translucent cascade of the shoulders, and would not glisten like a wild beast's fur, would not from all the borders of itself burst like a star. For here there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life. The message from the gods, where once our task was taken up by them, done by them, led by them, now the broken God sending through time the message, as we look upon the ruins of the visage and the countenance of gods, saying, you must change your life. there is still the presence of someone leading in a way, but the leading is saying, the only leading that's in it is saying, you must do this now. This is your task. This is up to you. I've been with you and with you and with you, but now I send you from your sense of my presence and majesty in the past through time to touch you now, to ask you to act and to feel and to think.
What do we do? Because we know the time is upon us. We many people feel the need for this change. It has that call of St. John's. I'm about to start the St. John's Preparation Festival this weekend, 3 weekends of that. And what, you know, that voice calling in the wilderness, change your heart and minds. We're given that as a call in the spiritual year, every year, change your heart and minds. And so every year we get this idea of there is this renewal. Every year we get this idea of this fiery tongue. How do we ensure for the change to occur unless we participate, unless we put ourselves in it and not just be onlookers? And that's the problem with the intellect. It believes it can understand everything without changing itself. And the difference between the intellect working alone and the intellect in relationship to the heart's always in a relationship of experience. It's feeling experience along with what's understood. And so this deep understanding through thinking and the heart has this possibility of really changing us. And then we're unlikely just to be living a life which is empty forms, just following something we don't even necessarily know why we're doing it, or doing the good because we're told it's good, but not our heart is not behind it, our mind's not behind it. And then our life itself feels like it's not fully enriched with my being or the being of love, which is what we're really working towards. So for myself, I'm looking at, you know, what is the common thread, you know, with the pandemic, with all the things that have been going on, listening into what is it that everybody's saying, you know, from the atheist to the highly developed initiates. And everyone is really saying we need more moral development. And so for me, I decided to begin to work with virtue practice for that reason. Because in the practice of the virtue, one begins to get to know love in its multifaceted way. Because we think we know what love is, we think we know the being of love, but actually our whole journey is part of that understanding. And it's bringing our thoughts into our hearts experiencing activity with the virtue that we start to get a sense of, wow, love, it's so extraordinary. And these little things I thought were love are just little windows to this vast possibility. And so in this love, in the act of it, there for me is where I experience the greatest liberation. Not in the choice to love or not love, where most people think is where their freedom lies. It's actually in the loving that I feel most free. Now, of course, there's whole lots of aspects of desire that are incredibly unfree, and people have united with the word love, infatuation and all of these unfreedoms, karmic experiences. But actual love united with is where the liberation, the freedom is really grasped. And when Rudolf Steiner says in the spiritual world, love and freedom are synonymous, that comes home to me in this experience. So coming to know love, understanding the absolute necessity of the heart's relationship to our future, and meeting the being of love that can continue to unfold with us as we grow into it.
Yeah, I love, first of all, I love the last piece there of continue to grow as we grow into it. Let me see if I can explain why. So much that's been happening for me lately has been this emptying out, you know, like that prayer in the beginning, this purification, which is something that's, I would say, quite unpopular now, like purification. And I don't, I'm certainly not demanding people purify, you know, in the ways that I do or see this or that as pure. But it, in other words, it's making room. I mean, in some ways you can't really ever empty anything out. You can just add the capacity to receive more. So I'm allowing more space within me for whatever needs to be received. And it's a painful process. It's not pleasant in a lot of ways. It brings a lot of crying, a lot of intensity. And yet I still know in the pain that there is a love that's there. And this is very different. It's like this thing that's hanging out in all the experiences that's like seeing what I'm going through in the purification. It knows that love is present. And that's, it's so different than a kind of occluding despair. Even though some of the conditions feel just as bad as they might have in those times. And so when I say, well, when you're saying you fill into it, you emerge into it, why I like that is, you know, someone asked me what sacrifice was the other day, because I was talking about sacrifices. Well, could you talk about what sacrifice is more? And I was just like, look, it's entering the form. It's commitment to commitment to what is given to me in the task. That's all it is. If I don't know what I'm going to have to sacrifice. The sacrifice, when you're just making sacrifices to appear spiritual or be spiritual, is really just kind of a disavowal in a way. And I'm not, if people want to do that, that's fine too. There can be regimens, routines, you know, Ignatius, Loyola kind of stuff. Fine if you don't do that. But what I'm talking about when I say sacrifice is a commitment to receive what is given. And that requires removing aspects, pouring them out, making room. And as I do that, I begin to fill the form that's awaiting me.
Yeah. Look, every path meets this idea of purification, partly because we need to make room, as you say, and then something else can actually be there. But we have these old ideas of purification. And the interesting thing is the old texts still have true resonance, but we have to perceive them in a new way in order that they actually can work in on us. There's a few pictures of that in this little book, Light on the Path. I've worked with this book for many years, but I just read.
Can you just say where that's from so people know?
Light on the Path is a small book by Mabel Collins. Rudolf Steiner spoke about this as giving us the ability to awaken the higher eye, one of the books that if you work with it. I worked with it for 7 years straight, and it is an absolute gem. But it is, you know, it's incredibly esoteric. Every stanza has its layers. So let me just talk about this first purification part, because even though these are pictures, it really speaks of what you're talking about. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. That's the purification picture. And it's a purification picture which ensures that as we do this really important work in the mystery center of the heart, that we don't create a discord that repeats those old patterns. So purification is a way of not taking your personal particular self into that inner temple. So usually when I'm working with a virtue, I suggest first someone put their everyday self to one side. And that's a sort of meditative technique that we do in order that you can still do the work of the future without yet being so-called perfect. But the purification is also to be able to put that to one side, to not take that with you into the heart's work. So like if you are entering into some great mystery center or a revered place, the church, a special temple, you would go in with this respect. Well, maybe perhaps not today because we managed to lose that for every place, but you consider that in your own inner microcosmic being. And in a way, the objectivity that's cultivated through thinking is part of putting the everyday self to one side. And that's why objective thinking can be a really important tool, because it allows you to not stand in that personal subjectivity to the world. So it gives you that ability to look upon yourself, to witness yourself. And then in that witnessing, you can leave it to one side and then enter into this mystery center of your own heart. And this for me is one of the most profound experiences I'm having more and more. You know, when I'm able to be there with myself in this heart center and someone else is able to be there in the mystery center of their heart, when two or more gather in this place, something else is possible. And it doesn't matter what church you belong to, what philosophy you've followed, what divine ideal you have. It doesn't even matter if you're an atheist. If you can meet in the mystery center of your heart with another human being, something new is possible. And I'm beginning to experience this with various people. And it is a bridge that I've never found before, because I've always thought you're going to need to have a spiritual life for me to meet you. And now I'm realizing that actually you don't need that. What you need is love. That's it. The connection to the being of love, and we can meet there. Now, that isn't sentiment on any sense of the word. And one of the reasons I do the practice of the 12 virtues that become the 24, you know, master principles, is just so that people can begin to formulate a relationship to love. And you will find certain doorways, certain aspects of this being more relevant to you. And as you meet that, you can always go there then. So even when you're having the hardest time with someone, I try to be totally present and heart-orientated. And then between us, something else is possible. And then with, you know, friends, colleagues, those that are working, I'm feeling this, you know, this richness of what Steiner talked about as this reverse ritual. We're no longer out there in the mystery center doing these external ritual forms, but we're connecting in this individual to individual meeting, in this mystery center of our hearts. And this is allowing for us to find a way to the living spiritual life that is always around us and with us, but mostly we're asleep to it.
So when we talk about this meeting in the mystery center of the heart, first the in it is something to think about that, right. We need to we need to find ourselves in a space, which is not a space. And we need to connect with people timelessly, in a way. Now, we're calling it a mystery center. Is it because it offers us? Yeah, it is. Yeah. I don't have to ask. I know the answer. That when we're within that, when we're within that center, and also in a way standing within the being, and we talk about this as Christ, that we have left the time and space of the material world in a way. I find this really profound, that when you meet someone in that space, actually, I'm not saying there aren't all kinds of hooks and snags and everything that can sort of pull you back in to materialism, but you're fulfilling the promise of that Christ being, which is that the world in some ways, or maybe I won't say the world, that the earth will not affect you in the same way, that the concerns of materialism won't touch you in the same way, because you've entered into this timeless, spaceless space to meet someone else. So I find that really beautiful. I think we can get a little bit of a feeling of that if you who are listening are, first of all, lost in what we're saying, I can get a feeling of what it's like to be in a timeless, spaceless dimension when you meditate. There can be a sense of it. It's not the same as what we're talking about, but think about when you sit down for 5 minutes and you really enter into meditative space, and when you open your eyes again, it's like, you know, the fledgling bird, like, look, where am I? You know, how long was I gone? Oh, the alarm didn't even go off yet. I've only been meditating for 4 minutes. You get, you understand that the concerns of the world, they're still there, but they reach you in a different way. They have to transmute if they want to even approach you or touch you in that state. So it's very different. It's very different. So I want to say that just to, so people might get a little bit of a bearing of what you mean, because again, I think it's very different than saying, well, just, you know, meet somebody and be nice. I mean, that's a great start. And I'm not dissing on that either. You know, it's definitely good to meet someone with a just kind of gentleness and happiness in your heart, but it's beyond that.
Yeah, but I think this is what's so exciting about it on one level, is that we're at the beginning of understanding all of these attributes, these capacities of love. Now, from my understanding, every soul comes into the world with a capacity of love, something to give. But we're also all here to grow in that. So if I can be not just present in my ability to be an onlooker to myself, but also allow this activity of the heart sphere where I am present to really feeling and experiencing what the other is saying and how they are being and all of the aspects around, that level of presence, it's not just as an onlooker, not with them, it's not just about being mindful. Mindful is important, but it's being heartful as well. It's really a place of, or soulful, where you bring yourself to the meeting with the capacity that you have. Now, we bring ourselves often to meetings with a grasping, a wanting to have, a wanting to hold, a wanting to gain, a wanting to be seen, a wanting to be adored, or, you know, some needing to be appear a certain way. All of these other things are, you know, that are kind of the poisons of the chalice. You know, they have to be purified. But what if I don't want to be seen or any of those things? All I want is to meet you here. And to, between you and I meeting here, something else may come about. And that, for me, is just so enriching to the experience of life. But it is life. It's the difference between the stream of consciousness of the initiation path and the lawfulness of the form of the sort of pastoral religious path, and both meeting in the heart of life. Mm-hmm. It, and it has to take place in this living moment. Mm-hmm. So it takes us beyond purely being mindful, but to actually say, to be mindful and full in this heart space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because mindfulness is an attentiveness to what's given to you, what's being given to you. It is a doing. There's an act there. But I, you know, when we talk about it being in the heart, I obviously you're not talking about the physical heart, although the physical heart has a relationship to it. But one way in which we can understand that in relation to the physical heart is that the beating of our hearts is given to us. So it is a process that is going on because all the constitutive forces and beings that make up our body are running that show. And to go to the place that is given and then to give to give up and to be there, you know, with the other, I think that that's a good picture of how this works. And again, it's like Easter and Whitsun, the moving and then the fixity, both must be held and done at once. I think, or stability, I should say, maybe not fixity, but, so I want to just sort of, again, maybe pull back and talk about what this actually looks like for people, because I know what it looks like in my own life, but if people are going to look upon the world and say, oh my gosh, look at every single problem. There's so many problems in the world. Are we saying that all we need to do is meet someone in love and just practice that, and then the problems of the world will dissolve? And in a funny way, the answer is yes, which is great, but it's not enough to just say yes to that. You know, and I think that's what people who sort of mystify this process or their inclinations to or sense of the truth of this might say, like, yes, that's all all you need is love. I mean, that is true. But that's true. What does that mean? What does that mean?
So for instance, if I meet out of my continual egotistical need for personal greatness, there isn't love. As much as I want to say I'm going to meet in my heart, I'm actually meeting for another reason. You know, if I'm meeting to take or to keep, to hold, and worse still, to advance at the expense of another human being, or to hold on to something at the expense of another. These thoughts, these esoteric thoughts, they are thieves of love. So, yes, all it is love, but how do you allow that space one has to actually do this purification process. And that's not as easy as it sounds, because it's not a one-off thing. I've done my purification. I did my colonic irrigation, and now I'm done. No.
It's called a frenema. Yeah.
And I'm done. No. It's constant. So preparation and purification is consistent even when you've achieved illumination, and even when you're on the path. You know, Buddha Stani gives that wonderful picture that the great initiate has to keep an eye on their shadow the whole time, or it could actually take them out.
Or it will kill them.
Yeah, it will actually kill. Now, that's a very important aspect. So love is not something you can go, well, now I love. It's just about love. It's actually a continual practice, right? It's a practice. But the practice means actually working about all of that in you that's not love. And that's one of the greatest, hardest, rudest awakenings on the path, is you realize at some point everyone has to say, I realize how little love lives in me. And that's actually a useful starting point, because now we know where we are and where we need to grow. And so the objectivity, the capacity of clarified thought, allows you to have this light of insight. But it's useless on its own if it is not coupled with the love that is really the transformative force of our age. And the reason why all of us are here, but we all have some love. Mm. Now, this idea that Rudolf Steiner brings, that actually our growing relationship to the being of love takes place in this active dynamic through life. That once you pass the gates of death and you're in the spiritual world, you're processing and transforming what has been taken with you. But the actual development and evolution happens while in life. It's not in the realm of consciousness, and it's not in the lawful realm of form, but when they come together, it's not in nature or in God, but in the human being, when it's all united, that we can actually take these steps towards love and freedom. So what an extraordinary opportunity life is, and yet all the diverting forces will help you forget who you are and why you're here. And this anesthetizing world will completely drop away the realities.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. So I'm going to give an example from my life then. You know, I definitely had for a long time, over time, developed the capacity for being, for expressing vulnerability. So, you know, I was able to tell people when I was hurt, to communicate when this or that had, or this or that had happened in my life, and that was difficult for me. And I became so good at it, in fact, that it became really easy to manipulate people by showing them where the wound was, by showing them, by performing how I was hurt. And now this has exploded, obviously, in the kind of attention economy, you know, that we have now, where to express your vulnerability and your wound is actually, we'll even identify fully with the wound now and talk about where that is. You can make a lot of money doing that. And I'm not saying that just because you make money off of it, it's bad, or I'm not saying that at all. People have written books about times when they were hurt or wounded that are really beautiful and do actually help others. But you can really, really refine this to the point where you actually don't know how much you are controlling other people by expressing it. If you get in a fight with someone, say you get in a fight with your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your husband, your wife, and you can see that they're kind of seeing where you're going in the argument, and you can see that they're still upset. And then you start crying. You're like, I've just had a really hard day. Things have been really difficult lately, blah, blah, blah. And then they get up and they hug you and the fight is over. I'm not saying don't do that, because sometimes you got to shake the keys to stop the baby from being upset. But but I am saying, take a look at the times when you think you are actually being fully open, fully loving, fully yourself, and you're actually fooling yourself and fooling the openness. We do this in so many ways. It permeates, that double self permeates every aspect.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think one of the ways to approach this, you can't always get at it directly is the problem, because then you'll just try to do in the investigation what you do with other people sometimes. So, you know, Peter Dunov has this thing that we talked about on episode 222 with David Lorimer. He says that love is the beginning of life. Truth is the end of life. And I mean, it's a really startling thing to say, but as you said, everybody comes in with love, the ability to love. But we don't know the truth of who we are in relationship to that love until we die, until we see the entire arc of our lives. So a way to deal with that for me is in the morning when we are born and before bed as we are dying, we can do two little things. One is from Peter Dunov and one is from Daskalos, although Rudolf Steiner has his own version. You wake up and the first thought you have, I'm sure other thoughts will slip in anyway, but try for your first thought to think, God is love. And to do that with the exuberant happiness of a child that you actually are in touch with, not to just, ha ha ha, the God is love. I mean, I don't want to force it, but to try to find that in yourself, to get in touch with the birth of yourself into the world with the knowing of the love of God. And when you go to sleep, you do introspection. So when you're encountering the truth, you do, in Rudolf Steiner's version, it's called the Rückschau, where you review the day backwards. But in Daskalos's version, you don't have to review the day backwards. You just review the day with a sense of equanimity, and you just pick out one thing, and without condemning yourself, without getting upset or angry with yourself, you just think, huh, I could have maybe done that this way. Okay. And then you start to fall asleep. So you look at the day with a sense of truth, who you were across the lifetime of your day as you fall into sleep. And those two exercises, and what comes in between is a wisdom sense, but what those two things can frame the day to allow wisdom around all your other actions to start to show.
Yeah. Well, could I add something to it? Even though,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please.
God is love. So I would say like this, to connect to your divine ideal, because whatever that is the thing that makes that turn inwardly. And you know it's your divine ideal and not some borrowed, indoctrinated ideal, because what it does to you inwardly, you almost don't have to cultivate that quality, because the true divine ideal lifts something in you. And then in your review, you're assessing yourself according to your divine ideal.
Right.
So I wouldn't have it someone else's God and someone else's assessment.
Right.
I would have it as your divine ideal and your assessment. Because then you bring in the real initiation work and not the religious stream of form, because you might, you know, beat yourself up for not such and such in, but whose idea was that anyway?
Right.
Now, there are, of course, different aspects to a practice. So, you know, when I'm working with these monthly virtue practices and you're learning to each day just go to the heart and be with a particular virtue, I'm not actually suggesting people go out and then be compassion. No, I just think just gently into the heart and build your relationship to it. Because then when it comes out of you, it comes out of you not as an empty form, not as a, like, I'm going to go be a compassionate person today and then look back and beat myself up for not being it. Mm. But actually your cup overflows. It comes from you. And it's really wonderful because when you look at something like devotion and inwardly experience, what is my inner activity of devotion?
Mm.
And then look at something like compassion. What's my inner activity of compassion? You start to feel you're coming to know the facets of God. Now, virtues have been developed by every tradition, every religion. There's not a single that doesn't have some way of looking at the practice of the virtues, because virtues is health to the soul. It really brings about this life-giving experience to the inner world when we work on those practices. But I would say the difference is now is we have to find what is that in me,
mm-hmm.
not what is that told to me, and where can I find it? Can I discern the difference between this quality of devotion and a quality of compassion or a quality of faithfulness? Can I discern these subtle movements? Because all of these principles in the heart begin to reveal themselves as different stream qualities, activities that begin to reveal love in this very deep presence of being, and not, you know, a sentiment that, you know, I enjoy you and therefore I call it love.
Well, it's tricky because on the one hand, we are saying that the substance of this version of the cosmos is love. So you can't escape love. But so what happens? You can only occlude love with love, which is very confusing. You can't do anything to it. I mean, it's all there is. So it's not the difference between are you loving or are you not loving. It's the difference between are you experiencing love in this way or in this way.
When we practice love, cultivate love, creative forces pour into the world. So love is, and yet what happens? Love is, you're right. But what happens when a human being practices love, cultivates love?
Mm.
And these creative forces, which are the future becoming, come into the world. And that's where we participate with a future willed by the gods, for want of a better way of putting it. And what is the other option? Well, we've seen it before, the rise and fall of great civilizations and cycles of time and time again. But we are working towards something. And what I really experienced today is happening is this individual ability to be responsible for that work in themselves, this great work of love. It's not a given anymore. You're not, this is a wonderful thing, really, even though some people say it's a disaster that we're not just all indoctrinated into some sort of religious order that keeps us good. Mm-hmm. But wasn't that extraordinary that it's not a given anymore? The empty form doesn't work. So it will only come alive through us participating because we choose to. And yet I'm going to say it again, the freedom is not actually the choice to participate or not. The freedom occurs when you actually participate in love. Then you'll experience what liberation is.
Yeah. Well, but so much of it, yeah, it's really important point that speaks to a lot of political people, a lot of spiritual or self-help kinds of people and lessons. one of the things that I would say is, you know, I think this can be really confusing for people. It was confusing to me for a really long time, and it still is in its own way. But as I sort of had inclinations or sightings of it, but didn't quite understand it. And now, even as I deepen my understanding of it, I'm still confused. But I think people are so concerned with what action they're going to take in the material world. And then as soon as you say, well, it's not really just that, then they think, oh, so I don't have to take action. I just have to work on myself. And then if they're very tricky, they'll think, well, the action I take is really just in my thought to engage with this or that. Like, oh, if I, you know, it's the Epictetus kind of thing, the Stoic thing. Like, it's the story of, you know, Christ seeing the dead dog and saying, look how beautiful the teeth are. Now, I'm not saying there's not wisdom and actually layers of wisdom in that apocryphal story, but there is also a way of viewing it, which is like, well, if I just decide to see this thing as beautiful, then that's where the real action is. But it's more than all of that is what you're saying. And I know that that's true now. And let me just maybe make a little bit of a distinction here that can point us in the right direction. Like, if you see the world and you're like, shit is falling apart, everything's bad, you know, wars, disease, hatred, you know, division being fomented between people, you know, immigrants, you know, falling off of boats into the sea and then getting into countries and being, you know, hated by the people that should be taking them in, et cetera, et cetera. You could look at all of that and feel despair, or then you could take this other step and be like, actually, everything is just going according to this loving plan, and that's how I'm going to see the world, which is a different kind of seeing. Or, and this is a different move, and it's important, I think, to recognize the difference. You could envision a world where we are enacting love with each other, which is a completely different imaginative move. Now, I know that that's not what you're talking about exactly, but I do think that the turn from one to the next, the turn from I'm deciding to see it a certain way to I'm deciding to create within myself new pictures of how it could be, moves us into a different space inwardly. Which is why, even though Rudolf Steiner didn't like this word, I knew he was talking about, I like utopia as a word, because if it requires you to move into a space of imaginatively and positively creating the world within, not just reacting to negative problems with a positive view, and also not just building a world based on what you don't want, instead creating within the new building in the ruins of the old, but building this new thing, then we have a little bit of a view of what kind of move needs to be made here.
Yeah, look, I think there is such a temptation to pretend that the world isn't as it is, and just I'll just stay in my own positive framework. But that isn't actually the reality of your own development, because you constantly come up against what is not love. So you're going to go and meet that outwardly or inwardly. So the question is, how are you able to do something about it inwardly? Because if you can, then you can also consider what you can do about it outwardly. If I can't meet, if I refuse to meet my shadow, if I refuse to meet my shortcomings, if I refuse to meet the errors in myself, then I have not learned what to do about the transformation of that. So how I actually participate in this world shadow, this world error, this world process. So there are people that are living in this way where they just refuse to engage with that reality, and yet it's part of this alchemical mystery of transformation that we need to engage with it. And to recognize our double, because if we don't, the double clouds our perception of the true spiritual worlds. We don't fully participate. It gets distorted. It becomes another part of this grandiose personality. Mm-hmm. It might look sweeter, but it's still an empty form and not a fully lived life. So we do the work and know how to deal with it in ourselves, because you're learning in knowing thyself, you really get to know how humanity itself works. You need to find these mysteries, right? The mystery of the abyss, one of the first mysteries, is the mystery of self-knowledge, because the abyss is crossing from one way of seeing to another. You know, to be able to meet the void, the emptiness, the aloneness, the isolation, all of these things that we find so hard. But without that mystery, how would we ever deal with the mystery of evil, which is a much harder mystery to deal with, one of which you're learning a lot about? And it's an extraordinarily important mystery to deal with in our times. But we work with all that through understanding all that's living in us in this microcosmic picture. Then we can also meet it in the world in a really true way. But if I can't adjust my own being, if I have no power over myself because I've not done the work with myself, or I've got something else to do it for me, how do I participate in the world's becoming? How do I sit with the question of what does the world need if I can't actually see that in the reality of my own inner work?
The abyss is really important, I think, to bring up. And like you said, we're going, you're working on a St. John's Tide lecture, this holiday about, holiday, do we even call it? Holiday of not knowing. But, you know, Patrick Kennedy, who's been on the show, he said to me once, you know, I was just talking to him about my life, and he said, you know, I know that, like, when a lot of factors come together and it's just a hard time in life because all these things are coming, I know that God is giving me something that I can't handle. Now, this is exactly to the contrary of the sort of more mainstream spiritual message, which is God will never give you anything that you can't handle. In fact, it has to be something you can't handle, because the congregation of factors become this presence for you that is wiser than you. And it leads you with it. So I think that's part of the thing that's really hard, is like, I'm working, when I say I mean, I'm hoping other people can relate to this. I am working on myself. I am emptying things out. I'm letting new things in, but I don't know where it's going. I can't see that, because where I'm being led is so much more profound than where I am now. So if I knew where I was going.
Absolutely.
Sometimes we do know. So I think sometimes that's also a little tricky. Sometimes we do get to a place where we're like, oh, that's the next thing that's coming. And then you do it. But that's like, you know, that's the mini boss in the game. You know, it's not the next thing. It's a refinement. Yeah. It's an adaptation. It's not an evolution, which is it's a refinement. Yeah.
Oh, look, I really understand that. And, you know, I say it to people time and time again, when you're working that dynamically with the mystery, they don't say, go for this door and then you'll see this and all this, and this is what it's all leading to. So it's just go through this door. And that's where all the trials occur and the growth and the strength arises from. Because if you knew exactly what all these things were going to become, well, one thing is that you can't know, because you can actually only know through actually extending your inner being to be able to embrace them. So actually we are all often offered things that are beyond our capacity. Mm-hmm. And then we grow into them. And I wish we could let young people know that. You're not meant to be on top of the game. You're not meant to be doing it completely well. We're growing into it. It's an extraordinary, wonderful aspect of this mystery.
I was just thinking before when we were talking about, you know, not actually confronting the double or the shadow or whatever, that, you know, the hope of new age manifesting kind of stuff is like, well, if I just really stay with the light, like the darkness can't get in. But first of all, the darkness is already there. So what do you mean it's not going to be able to get in? But okay, I actually really sympathize with that move. It's just that it's a step. As long as that's a step, then that's okay. Because that is something I think that people need to be able to do, is develop the capacity to stand in the light for a long enough time. Because that can also be unbearable. Think about people who don't know what they want in their lives. They've always been hopeless or whatever. Standing in the light is actually a very difficult thing for those people to do. So it's a step. And then like there's a relationship to the future in this step, which is I'm going to envision a day where everything's kind of going my way. I'm going to envision a day when I have this car or this house, I've accomplished this, I'm in this relationship, I'm whatever. Again, I feel like that's all okay. The problem is we're creating that day. One, of course, it's having materialistic components, but I'll leave that aside for a second. We're creating that day in reference to who we are now. So if we hold on to the day as we move into the future, we actually can't change. We actually are holding ourselves in place, becoming an object that blocks the sun and creates a shadow ourselves. So our own life becomes the shadow maker. So we have to actually allow that light to dissolve the future that we've created for ourselves and our identifying with that future as we move into it. So it's not bad. It's just when we hold it, you know, that's when it becomes, what's the line from a song I like? If you hold on to nothing for too long, you're just clenching your fists. You gotta keep moving. Yeah.
Well, the strange thing is, it actually is limited, because the you today is less than the you that you'll be tomorrow. So the you today can only manifest based on the limited self that you perceive yourself to be now. But what I know about this, my life takes me where I don't know myself to be, and then I grow into it. It's a different angle. But I think what's the most important thing in the sense is to understand that love and light have to be we need to come into a relationship with them and not see ourselves as sort of already got there. Because if we see ourselves as already got there, we are left in the limitation of it. But how do we be in relationship to it so it's an ever-growing into? I want the last day of my life to be, and this is where I've loved the most. Not, well, when I was back as a teenager, when I loved them. No, because if I'm living life, then my love is growing. My capacity for love is growing. Mm-hmm. And the capacity to embrace this mystery is really living in that. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about. It's about growing into beyond myself that I know myself to be today. And you're absolutely right. There is something guiding that. And I think that's where this being of love is so intimately connected to all our lives, whether we know it or not. And in this anesthetizing world, we know it less. And yet something's happening. And people are saying the new is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think just to go off of what you were first saying there, I mean, if you just think about, I know not everybody's going to be able to relate to this, but if you think about the person you were dating a while ago, years ago, and you were like, oh my gosh, the love of my life, you know, and then you broke up with them and it was awful and heartbreak. And then you met the partner that you were really meant to be with. I mean, I know that feeling, and I'm sure other people do as well, where the present is terrifying. The past feels like a waste. The future feels awful to even think about without that person. And then, you know, you find yourself with your willingness, your openness to love, in actually a completely transformed sense of your own being, you know, in relation to this other. And so that's just a way that people might be able to even relate to this, you know, transformation, that sometimes there are spiritual breakups going on that we don't know about that feel bad as we're transforming into the next aspect or phase of our lives. But there was something there at the end that, I mean, I think what people are really, well, a lot of people I know are really afraid of right now in the world is fascism. More than global warming or war or any of that kind of stuff. They might think that those are related, but they're really afraid of this rising resentment, the densification of the past, trying to hold on to old senses of allegiance and all that kind of stuff, often tied into religion in some way. And I think people really fear that. So that appears in a lot of ways as one, there are others, but one of the great enemies of this love and meaning in the mystery chamber of the heart. So I want to talk about that directly, because I don't want us to, it's not good to dwell on that stuff, but I know that that's probably coming up for some people as either they listen or just, you know, in their lives in general. So I think we should address that kind of what seems like proliferating presence. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it is actually proliferating, but it actually doesn't even matter if it is or not. We're definitely all, people are thinking about it more, and it's definitely proliferating people's thoughts, and it needs to be addressed as such there.
Yeah. And I think it's a reality. Like, if you look at the reality of your own self, when love is present, all that's not love becomes obvious. When the light's there, the shadow is seen. That I often try to say to people, if you can see your shadow, there must have been light. Mm-hmm. If someone can't see their shadow, then there's a little trouble, because the light isn't the true light. If you're not, it's not cast in any shadow force. What is that? What is that illumination that can't cast a shadow? Because the sun does, and that force, that cosmic body, reveals to us where the shadows are. So when people are struggling in the world, in a certain way, I feel like it always comes when we're on the verge of a new step. And there is always a desire to sort of go backwards harshly and hold on to the past, because I know that in myself. I know that in my own being, and that's why I begin to see it in the world around us. So you cling back at that moment but it's always darkest before the dawn. We hear these words, they're just statements, and yet they belong to the reality of being human. And so, yes, I think it is going to get worse because something else is actually shifting. And I'm not suggesting you don't therefore focus on it and just keep focusing on only the new. You always have to keep an eye on the shadow and participate where you can to not let it rule the life. But it's an important part to be aware of, because it tells us where we've made those mistakes before. You know, when you've got companies like BlackRock deciding they're going to pioneer the green movement, surely we say, come on, guys, you did a pretty bad job last time. Why would we hand it to you now? Uh-huh. You know, it's the same cycle. And it constantly get away with it because we forget, and we forget because we don't keep our eye on the shadow. And actually, they know it. They know that we will forget.
Mm-hmm.
They know we've forgotten already 2 years ago all the lies and the horrors that have affected the world. So, but we must keep an eye on the shadow. But let that be an understanding for the individual. How do you ever do that in the world if you're not doing it in your own being, in your own life? But the lawfulness of true inner development reveals how to work with the world. Inner development for world development. It's not inner development so you can get the hell out of Dodge and off the wheels of life and death. It's actually so we can really understand how to go forward. And you understand it through your own living reality. And if you can work with it in yourself, you can work with it in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the framing there of the fascism in my own being, which is the, I'm going to go back to the way things were. I can think of that. It doesn't feel like fascism when it's in me. Right, because I'm not a world leader, but it's like when I think about, well, I could just go live in LA again and do this and this and this and this. First of all, it's not to say I would never live in LA for a period of time. It's not about that. It's like, oh, I could just live in LA and live that kind of like, you know, cold brew coffee lifestyle that I had, or I could go back and be a university professor again. Like these things that make me feel so comforted to think about, the lure, the temptation is so strong. It's so strong. So
Absolutely. If
I felt like I could change the world by bringing us back, I had the station in this incarnation to do that, I can imagine the lure being even stronger and stronger. This is not to forget or even let people off the hook for having these positions and making this move. But that looks enjoyable to me. It doesn't look like fascism to me in my life. Right. And indeed, it's not fascism in the same way. But the impulse, the tug of what if I just, instead of overcoming my karma, just kind of lay back into that furniture that it's created for me, that shell, that living room that looks like living with that's populated with all my objects and the things I'm comforted by, but actually just keep me absolutely contained, you know? And this is, I'm borrowing that picture from Daskalos, who was like, sometimes he had to go to people that felt like they were sitting in their dining rooms after they died and be like, hey, you're dead. You know, so they would get out of their shell hell. This, we can even reproduce it when we are going to, when we go into the kingdom of the dead, So I love that. And, you know, so it's really important to look at these impulses. And I mean, this is something that anthroposophy is really great for, is always, let's look at the gesture. Don't just look at the content or the decoration on the gesture. Let's look at the actual gesture and see if we're enacting it. And that it's been very helpful for me in that mode for sure.
Yes, I would say that I always look at the two forms. A part of the sort of training is looking between the macrocosm and the microcosm. If I'm stuck on the macrocosm, I go in. If I'm stuck on the microcosm, I go out. It will always bring about a new perspective. And that new perspective you can find on it allows you then to come to a new, to movement, because the worst thing is getting stuck. Mm-hmm. Movement is important. If we get stuck and fixed and, you know, you begin to rigidify in a particular framework, then you're no longer alive.
Mm. Yeah. It's a beautiful picture too of, you know, the world of the angels and the world of the elemental beings. I'm just going to, let's see if I can make this all make sense. traditionally, a symbol of the world of the elemental beings is the white rose. It has a certain kind of relationship to a certain kind of light, this white rose light. And the world of the cosmic world, the world of the angels, has this sort of red rose, this deep red rose, and they mix together and form this pink rose. So if you think about going in and going out, you have this whiteness and this redness, and they're coming together. And in the center, this pink rose, which is something that we can unfold and open in our hearts. This maybe doesn't make sense to people, like, oh, I'm just throwing these symbols out. But spend a moment engaging with the thought of a pink rose opening and opening and opening above your heart. And see if that feels like anything to you. See if that indicates anything to you of the mixing of going up and going down, going in and going out, going into the microcosm, into the macrocosm. That opening, see if it can bring you into a certain kind of orientation to the urge to go up, down, in, out, and see what happens. For me, this isn't something I read, really. It's just something that started to open in me. For me, it gives a real connection to the what you're saying, the temptation of going somewhere rather than orienting myself to the pools and the directions and the different kinds of light and image that I'm receiving and the urges that I'm experiencing.
Well, what I really like about the image is that for me right now in everything I'm doing, I'm asking, how do we bring what would have been opposites together? Mm-hmm. In the human being, of course, it's the heart that takes this kind of nerve sensory system and this metabolic system and kind of mediates them in the very body. But, you know, how do we bring what would be opposite processes or processes that appear to be working in different directions and bring them together as this third principle? And that's really interesting for me, because in the mysteries that was always the case. You know, there were ways of working, and you were either in the, you know, going out to the cosmos or diving deep into the human being, and you were in a particular stream. But that's not the case anymore. Something happened with the mystery of Golgotha. Mm-hmm. Streams were brought together, and this is why love and the being of love is still yet to reveal itself mm-hmm. in our world. But we're beginning to understand that it's really in the working together that something new will come. Now, the difficulty is that in that process, we will experience greater and greater division, because that's the shadow of it. Mm-hmm. So how will you and I hold that ground? How will you and the person you meet next hold that ground? If you can have that community of life with one other person where you take into consideration the spiritual well-being of the other, and you do that day in, day out, that actually assists something of this task. And we're going to start small, and it will be between two or more just gathering in the light of that possibility. But it is the future, and we have to start somewhere.
You're reminding me of the fact that the sun is, in a lot of ways, or what has been named or discussed, called the heart of the cosmos in a way. That, and in fact, there are exercises where you try to regulate your heartbeat to the pulses of the sun itself. And we understand that those rays of light that come up from the earth and down from the heavens into us, that those are like blood, like a kind of circulation, but it's light. It's not blood. It's important to move away from blood in a sense. It's light. It's not blood. And that, in fact, we in our lives are the heart that will circulate the nourishment of those, of that light and of those presences. We'll circulate the nourishment of this world and the spiritual world so that we become the sun, that we become that pulse. And that's part of why we sync ourselves up to that, you know, the pulse of the sun. And that pink rose is the heart, that circulating of those. And in fact, if you think of the earth in an esoteric sense, we'd say the beings of the earth, all the elemental beings, the nature spirits, just the trees themselves, and so on and so forth, they're seeking to be brought into relationship to the heavens. This is what you were talking about before when we talk about morality. Everyone's seeking to re-infuse or recirculate a sense of real morality amongst us. The earth and the heavens, the earth and the spiritual kingdom are seeking each other, and they can only meet through the heart health of this realm, which is us. It's not, it has to happen through us in the same way that our blood genuflex through coming up and in vertically, you know, and out across, forming that cross within ourselves. So it's our work to, you know, work with this heart mystery. So yeah, anyway, that's the picture that comes
that through. That is our work. And I must say, it is joy to have you on that great work of love.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah.
Before we go, I did want to talk about how people can bring some of what they're hearing here forward, and what you're making available. Yeah.
Well, look, I have just started a YouTube channel called The Astral Arc, ARC, and on there you can participate in these monthly virtues. And there's various offerings there around the meditative form practice and how to work with the virtues. And the idea is that if people can see each other working with them, and that is built around this recognition of many hearts working together, that it in itself will support those that are looking for a path. There's many young people that are looking for an inner development path and finding, you know, it's a minefield out there of possibilities, not necessarily all leading to them finding themselves. Many of the paths leading to them losing themselves and not in the greatest mystery of what that means. So that channel was started, and I also follow the spiritual year on my with my colleagues, and you can look at my website innerworkpath.com, and you can come join us for the spiritual year. We do preparations before each of the spiritual festivals to really deepen a relationship to the mysteries behind them. And the esoteric work that supports us from engaging deeper and deeper so that the years are not wasted, but they are deeply lived.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to say, if you're listening to this episode like 7 months from now, there's so much on Lisa's website. There's so much there. So it's, you know, the lessons are there, interviews, all sorts of connections to other courses and offerings that she's putting out there. So even if you miss the time this time, there's still plenty there, and it's always updating. The heart doesn't get to stop until it stops. Well, listen, I'm so happy to talk about all this with you, and also to have everybody that's listening to just be also a part of this conversation, because you know, whenever I do an episode of the show, I really try to hold all of you in mind when we talk. But I think whenever I talk with you, Lisa, it becomes even more sort of pronounced that that this conversation is meant to live for the people that are listening as well. So thank you for holding that with me too.
Yeah, well, you have a big enough heart to do that, so we can find ourselves in you, my love.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening. Bye now.